All right. It's definitely my pleasure to introduce to you this afternoon Ken McClain, who probably does not need much introduction. For most of you who know that Ken is W.E.B. Du Bois Professor of Literature and Stephen Weiss Presidential Fellow here at Cornell University. He received his bachelor's, master's, and master of fine arts degrees from Cornell University, where he was also inducted into Phi Beta Kappa. He's taught at Colby College, the City University of New York, Williams College, where he was loose visiting professor of English, Wayne State University, where he was Martin Luther King Jr. Visiting scholar. He's won a number of awards for his teaching and for his writing. Walls, one of his works, was selected for inclusion in the Best American Essays College Edition 1995. The Antioch Review gave him the Distinguished Prose Award in 2002. He's won the Clark Distinguished Teaching Award at Cornell, as well as the Robert and Donna Paul Award for Academic Advising. From 1986 to 1990, he served as director of the Creative Writing Program here at Cornell. He's published 10 volumes of poetry and prose, and one of his essays, The Death in the Family, has been reprinted in a number of anthologies. And as I was reviewing his work, I went back and read that essay and was really struck by this particular observation. Here Ken is talking, The Death in the Family is about his brother who died of alcoholism. And here he's talking about his brother. He says, many of his friends would later become doctors, a few entertainers, all of them by the most incomprehensible and torturous of routes. The black middle class, if it can really be termed that, is a class made up of those who are either just too doggedly persistent or too stupid to realize that, like Fitzgerald America, their long sought after future remains forever beckoning and endlessly retreating. And I was just struck by that sentence and reflected on it and thought about Ken writing lovingly about his brother, and also about how individuals from the same families can really take different paths. If you read John Edgar Wideman and his discussion about his brother, or Michael Eric Dyson and his conversation about his brother, there's something, you know, how do we predict tragedy? How do we predict success? But let me not steal Ken's thunder. Ken has recently published the book Color, Essays on Race, Family, and History, and I assume, although he can do anything he wants to do, that he's going to share some of this work with us this afternoon. Please welcome Ken McClain.
Thanks, Bob. Wow. First of all, thank you so much for coming. I know there are a million things you could do. And let me say something else. I want to say that it is always a delight, a particular delight, a profound delight for me to be at Africana. I was a student in Africana as a freshman. I was here when Walter Rodney was here. I was here when George Lamming was here. Dr. Turner schooled me. I hope I don't embarrass him and others. But I want to say that for me, this has always felt like home. And I don't care how many places I go or don't go, I always feel invited and welcomed here. So it's just good to be back. Let me just say that I didn't intend, interestingly enough, to write essays. I had published 8 books of poems before my brother died. And after that, I literally stopped writing poems. I just started to write essays. I've always felt that poetry was, in effect, the highest of the arts, but that it should never be didactic. And the stuff that I had to talk about, I could only talk about in prose. Someday I hope that I'll get back to poetry, but maybe not. I've had a good run with essays. Interestingly enough, the essay is a magnificent form because anything you learned in poetry, you can use in an essay, right? And I would say that, and when I say that, meaning that I write, I would say, very poetic essays. They work largely in the ways that my poems did. There are a lot of sort of repeating tropes, and if things work, they do. Let me just say very quickly that Walls took at its center or its hub my brother. The new book, interestingly enough, Color, really has my parents at its center. I had a really sort of interesting childhood. I didn't realize how rarefied my childhood was. And when I say rarefied, I grew up in Adam Clayton Powell's house, which meant that I knew, but I was very young then, okay? So it meant that I knew, I saw Miles Davis, Duke Ellington, Paul Robeson, Dr. Martin Luther King, when I was really young, 5, 6, 7, 8, okay? The tragedy, and I think that those of you who are historians would well understand this, is that it was largely lost on me because all I cared about as a kid was whether they were nice to me, right? Duke Ellington was incredible. He used to love to just walk me around, right? And then he would sit down on the piano and let me just put my hands on it, and that's what I remember. Anyway, Color has 10 essays, all of which were published elsewhere. The first essay, I'm not going to go through all of them, but the first essay starts off with probably the most incredible experience I had, at least initially in my childhood. And that is when I went with my father. My father was a physician, right? Worked in Harlem by desire. My father never made more than $12,000 his whole life. He was a socialist, but he would never use that term, which I sort of fault him for, right? I mean, this guy, I remember, interestingly enough, I didn't know. I thought we were wealthy because my parents were really incredible. We never saved any money, but they spent every dime they had on us, on we as kids, okay? And when I'd go around Harlem, people would come up to us, right? And they would just talk about my parents, right, as these kind of saints in a kind of rather complicated way. Because my father, right, you know, my father would had brought all kinds of kids into the world. And the way they were paid, interestingly enough, was literally by theater tickets. Because where we lived in Harlem, right, a lot of people were artists and stuff. So we go to I saw every show on Broadway, literally. I ate every kind of pie. I've probably had every possible, right, confection in terms of food, right? And more importantly, I probably have been hugged by more wonderful and wondrous people than you can imagine. All right, my father's going down with me to Macy's to buy a radio for my mom. And as we're going down the elevator, all of a sudden, this white woman just slaps my father, literally, in the face. My father looks right at her, turns around and says, "Lady, I'm not going to be slapped for something I didn't do," and slaps her right back. Now, for me, this is extraordinary, as you can well understand. It's also extraordinary because remember when you're 5 or 6, you have, as everyone does, these beliefs, first of all, you don't hit women, blah, 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 that stuff. But there's also something else. Remember, in 1957, there are almost no black people in the Tonier stores in those days. Now you see them, right, in Macy's. But then we were a rarity. And I remember those white guys, their initial response was, "I'm going to do something about this," right? Right? And my father then looked at them and he said, "Listen, I did not do anything to this woman and I am not going, right, to be chastised or have something like this happen for something I did not do. But if you feel that you've got to make this, you know, the okay corral, Then let's begin, but let's only make it a fair fight. Who's first? I've always thought about that, you know. What I'm trying to say is my father graduated first in his class, right, from Boston University in 3 years, right? Was not in 1937, where they were not taking black people, right, in the medical schools in Boston. My grandfather was a minister. He didn't have any money. So my father was just trying to stay there, pretty much. And he couldn't get in. I mean, they wouldn't accept him. Finally, he got in a very elaborate way and graduated in 3 years, right? First in his class from med school, okay? So, I mean, they were, and my mother, same thing, extraordinary people that way. And I'm, in some ways, I think, in that whole business with that woman, all that stuff comes to bear. You know, the old Baldwin thing about we all have that bigger in the back of our head. Okay. With your permission, I'm going to read the title essay in this, Color. This is for my mother. My mother was, if nothing else, the picture in this is worth the price of the book. I mean, everything that's happened to me has been downhill since then. Color for my mother. In 1977, when my mother was in her early 60s, she needed to produce her birth certificate to apply for Medicaid, a rite of passage fraught with enormous trepidation, especially for someone of my mother's near ecumenical disengagement. She simply would not entertain any act of bureaucracy or officialdom. Irreproachably the artist she was, my mother kept her mind uncluttered with those things she deemed immaterial. She would pay the paper lady because everyone needed money, and she admired the woman's truculence. Yet she would never pay the water bill or the real estate taxes. And it was not simply that my father handled those things. Things were never that simple. It was that these commitments were beyond her compass, as cut off from her world as marzipan and a mongoose. And as you might expect, in her cooking too, there was a discreet inattention. When she would remember to include all the ingredients, she would make a splendid spaghetti. At other times, there would be a wonderfully restrained sauce, spaghetti immaginara, I used to call it, which would involve a slight tossing of cloves and peppers and a faint sprit of tomato. Sometimes, in all honesty, these creations were quite marvelous, the loss of one staple overshadowed by the pungency of another. And sometimes, with my mother's fullest approbation, it was good that we lived in close proximity to two Chinese takeouts. Surprisingly, my mother had never been asked for her birth certificate in 62 years, and its whereabouts were, to put it kindly, obscure. Finally, after a flurry of scurrying every possible inch of our Harlem home, even descending in our favorite hideaway, the not-to-be-touched window seat box with its tangles of papers, my mother conceded that it had been lost. So, with little fanfare, she dutifully sent off a request for a duplicate to Boston, Massachusetts, where she had been born, and it came in the mail in a few days. My mother, as was her wont, didn't open the letter for a week. It sat out on the library table with the unread crisis magazine, the AARP bulletin, and a few announcements. But one day, after my father had come home early from the office, my mother opened the letter, and I overheard her tell him with much force, "There must be a mistake. We have to do something. We'll take a trip." My mother was being characteristically theatrical, since she used to do summer repertory, but this was not her intention. She was merely reverting to a past life where the world had made sense to her, a time in which she had acted with Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson, drilling the summer residence of Martha's Vineyard with weighty theatrical fare, including Five Takeaway Two and The Little Foxes, a play that caused its author, Lillian Hellman, who lived on the island and attended the opening night performance, to upbraid my parents brutally for changing the word nigger to negro in my first encounter with the intricacies of authorial intent versus the wishes of a custodial community. Miss Hellman, though formidable, lost the argument. She threatened to sue to stop the play, but Dashiell Hammett, her paramour, like a provident voice from offstage, pronounced, "Lillian, this play is about language. This is the world, these people." Miss Hammett, Mr. Hammett was speaking about my mother and the others, most of whom, though mediocre actors, were heroic participants in the civil rights struggle, then overtaking the country. There was Dr. David Spain, the clinical pathologist, who performed the autopsies on the slain civil rights workers, Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, president of the, in Mississippi at great personal peril. Kivi Kaplan, national president of the NAACP, would give everyone a keep smiling card. 2 decades before the button craze, at a time when the world seemed bereft of anything humorous, with a seemingly omnipresent litany of dead civil rights workers, the endless legal batters, the country mired in obfuscation, nullification, and perfidy, and Bill Preston, who, in a foolhardy attempt to dramatize how the cattle prod could be used by segregationist police to immobilize a part of the body, stuck the small, cylinder-shaped generator into his arms and watched his fingers turn a sickly mauve, his arm as hapless as ice cubes in Saudi Arabia. These were the true actors, Hammett reminded Hellman. "Get off your high horse, Lillian," he said, winking at her. Suddenly, my mother used the word, "damn," with a sense of vitriol unknown to me, her hand clutching the open letter, the birth certificate. Although my mother could make a look an omen, she never used profanity. This day, my father was quiet, his entire bearing as quiescent as slag water. He had patients to see and hospital rounds to make. From his tepid response, I could tell that my mother's angst could not concern him, at least not in a physical way. And I could tell, just as powerfully, that my mother was not to be deterred. "I was home from college," I heard my mother offer. "I'd take a few days off, we'd settle this thing." My mother had rightly perceived that my father, though compassionate, was sliding off center. Like an underpowered tractor, he meant to take the crest of the hill, but it would not happen in this world or the next. For my part, I hadn't yet learned how to dodge my mother's gargantuan enthusiasms. I hadn't, in all honor, ever wanted to. Still, I had never seen my mother so discombobulated. As was the case with many people, my mother, nay, Genevieve Dora Green, had been born at home in 1913 in Dorchester, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. The physician had come to her house, helped in the delivery, identified her gender, and specified her race. As her mother, my mother was light-skinned, lemony, as some of the black community term it, and the doctor with dispatch assumed she was white. Although located in the North, Boston was hardly the cradle of egalitarianism its founders celebrated. The doctor, like my mother, lived in a world with color defined, and he followed its dictates. He presumed, and one could easily see why, that my mother had to be white. And even if she were possibly not, the consequences of which he could barely imagine, wouldn't she prepare to cast her fate with the Cabots and the Lowells, those who had the fine mansions on Beacon Hill? For his part, the doctor didn't wish to trouble my grandmother, who was vexed enough after the long delivery. And why would he dare to question her heritage and pedigree, for she certainly looked white, in a town and nation where race was the harbinger of all that life offered? No, it was clearly better to be white, the doctor reasoned, and so my mother was white, plain and simple. And in truth, my mother could easily be seen as Caucasian if one did not know that black people are often olive-skinned, and many of us in the country, however we may try to hide it, have been blessed by the Nile and the Thames. For black people of my generation, it's a private joke, albeit a grisly one, to infer who it might in fact be black. Some people are clearly passing, and they often suggest to you almost subliminally that you shouldn't turn them in. Others, through the various intrigues and circumlocutions of fate, have never been made to confront the resonant sting of the starbush, which, though no less problematic, still incurs my awe and sympathy. In questions of race, one can get both angry and saddened at the same time. It is not pleasant to confront someone who sees your racial life as trivial or immaterial, even should that disregard be based on guilelessness or ineptitude. Still, no one wishes to see a person of color, however misguided, hurt. I must stay here, as my wife reminds me, that I'm dangerously limited by my own experience. Race for me is a Rosetta Stone. It informs everything, and it is the landscape, if you will, by which all my determinations are made. Those younger than I, those in the After I Have a Dream generation, see their lives differently. They believe, or at least some of them maintain, that race is simply one of the ingredients in their self-orchestrated, Bula-based identity. For me, if I can carry the metaphor a bit farther, the pioneering chef is far less the determinant. I'm not sanguine about my ability as an epicure, nor has the world, at least in my experience, proved otherwise. Though I do know that the world has changed, that the terrors that challenged my parents were of a vastly different order than those I now confront, I also know that I have been called nigger, that people have questioned my right to prevent certain establishments, and that I still remain a problem for many of my countrymen, as the omnipresent affirmative action debate ever affirms. Although I am less in danger of being bludgeoned by pipes and burned by cattle prods, I have encountered and far too often the overlong, dirty glance under the thinnest of pretense, which confirms me as a probable thief or rapist and hurls me out of the sanctuary. And yet, to be honest, much of my race consciousness stems from my parents' lives, where race was the essential calculus. When I was young, everyone mentioned the race of those with whom they met. When we talked about black people, one's race was usually invoked simply as an indication that the person was not white. But when we talked about white people, the mention of race implied something far mysterious, unruly, and in need of definition. Whiteness, since it was so much a force in our life, and often a negative one, had to be delimited as if we were talking about a natural phenomenon, which, like the wind, could be a slight winnowing or a mighty hurricane. I will recall the proverbial Bill Preston, you know, the white guy who helped with fundraising for the NAACP? He really brought in a great deal of money. Or Millie Cohen, the pretty white woman who took in the Freedom Riders, she was fearsome for being so short. This articulation of race here was meant to suggest difference positively, to place this person in context and against all other inferences. In my parents' generation, most white people, sadly, were not Bill Prestons or Millie Cohens. They were not pioneers or revolutionaries. They were simply human beings, inspirited by fears, exhortations, the tentative joy of a baby's first step, and the often far too powerful sorrowings of this world. This next line I have to laugh at, and those of you who are black will know where it comes from. And yet, there were good white people. When my father was set to graduate from medical school in 1939, the first black to earn a degree from a Boston medical school in 30 years. He initially could not attend his graduation banquet since the Boston hotel it was to be held in was segregated and blacks and Jews were not welcomed. But when my father's best friend, the only Jewish student in the class, told his parents that my father and he were barred from the festivities, his parents brought the hotel in a flurry of entrepreneurial aplomb hard to imagine. On the night of the banquet, the hotel proudly proclaimed, "Congratulations to the class of 1939. We are new under new management. Everyone is welcome, everyone." Or I well recall when my parents wanted to buy a house on Martha's Vineyard in 1941, when the island was a lovely unknown atoll. My father had discovered the island in the most unusual manner. At age 14, escaping his minister father and a difficult mother, my father had slipped out of an ongoing tug with nary a word to his family and plied the coast from New York Harbor to Nova Scotia, working as a steward. In very rough seas off the Elizabethan Islands, his tug foundered, and he and his crew spent 10 days on the vineyard during the inquest. In later years, my father would always refer to Martha's Vineyard as, quote, God's lifeboat, although as he became older and the Calvinism leached out of him, the religious implications of this utterance impelled him simply to term the island magical. Initially, no one could sell my parents a home in other than the small black community on the island. Like Boston, Martha's Vineyard was teeming with prejudice. The homes sold by realtors to blacks were small, shack-like, and dreary. My parents wanted a house with a view, a large porch, and some land, and they had the money. Finally, After seeing a covey of less than helpful realtors, my parents came upon the office of one Homer T. Bodfish, which is not a contrived name. They got names in Massachusetts. There was another guy I know, Ernest Stepwistle. I mean, it's wild stuff. Mr. Bodfish was a thin, wiry man whose only physical movements were ones of great consequence, as if his very physiology was anchored to the Earth's axis. When my parents knocked on his door, he initially waved them off, saying, "I've made enough money today. Go away." But my parents would not be deterred. Finally, Mr. Bodfish let them in, and my father told him about my family's desire to purchase property on the vineyard, good property, property that Mr. Bodfish himself might like to own. Saying nothing, Mr. Bodfish looked them over and then pointed to a massive stack of newspapers balanced like an adroit seal. They were Father Divine missives, full of the prophet's tract on religion, one's responsibility towards others, and racial harmony. Father Divine had created large interracial congregations across the country, full of people who would do anything for the prophet. At some eating places run by the faithful, a chair remained always at the ready for Father, should he arrive. Mr. Bodfish asked my parents if they knew a Father Divine, and my parents disclosed how much they valued Father's service. Father Divine's minions often acted as hospice workers for my father's patients. For a mere dollar a day, they would nurse a bedridden patient dawn till dusk. My parents must have said the right thing, because Mr. Bodfish volunteered, "I'll show you one house. If you don't want it, that's it. One house. Come tomorrow." And then he rose dismissively, his body moving as if it were one lean piston. My parents brought that divine house. It was designed by Thomas Goethals, the architect of the Panama Canal, and it was truly gorgeous, with a 300-foot porch, a palatial sunroom, and a view of Oak Bluffs Harbor, which is one of the loveliest vistas on the island. Interestingly, the neighbors took a long time to warm to my parents, and I use the word warm, as you will soon understand, with a slight snicker. Incredibly, one family literally moved their house away. 3 weeks before my parents were set to move in, they were confronted with a massive gash in the countryside. The house, like the omnipresent vineyard fog, had mysteriously scampered off. Less original, the other Yankee neighbors simply kept their stony distance, and one understood why, as a friend admonished me, they could burn witches here. In truth, rarely, if ever, did anyone ever speak to anyone in my family, with the exception of my sister, who was, to put it mildly, irrepressible. With her boundless wanderlust and her uncontrollable gaiety, even the stoic New Englanders could ill contain themselves. But with my parents and me, the neighbors continued to act as if we were an infestation of locusts. If they waited long enough, we would surely disappear. Then, early one July morning, a young woman knocked on the door and in the finest of New England accents offered, excuse me, your house is on fire. And indeed it was. As a result of its ancient electric wiring, the back of the house was completely aflame, blazing as if it were a husk of dry wheat. My father, since he too was a New Englander, offered a hearty thank you with that laconic impassivity that must be genetically encoded. Although we lost a tool shed, a few trees, and a ratty bathroom, no one was injured. The fire was, in actuality, more smoke than ash. Irrefutably, after that episode, which must have impressed everyone with its utter absurdity, it seemed as if we had wheedled ourselves into the community. Suddenly, the voices opened, and the houses became welcome way stations for palaver on the slow walk downtown. Incredibly, we'd never known so many people lived beside us. Still, of course, there was the omnipresent litany of racial denials, denigrations, and humiliations that continued to confront my parents. In 1942, during the Second World War, my father offered to enlist in the army as a physician to aid in the war effort. He knew that men were dying in Europe, and he wanted to help. But because the Army Medical Corps was all white, they did not need his services. At the time, he received a very curt note, thanking him for his interest, but telling him that the hour was inauspicious. Then, a year later, after the number of maimed and dying doughboys had skyrocketed, two officers came to my father's office to beseech him to join the military. My father declined. As he told them, if I wasn't good enough for you 12 months ago, I'm not interested now. The army, now desperate for doctors, threatened to prosecute. My father remained adamant. During the war, he did treat patients sent statewide. He was a patriot, but he wouldn't enter the army. They'd have to threaten my children for me to go, he said many years later. I was a doctor then, I'm a doctor now, screw them. Ken, I love my father. Ken, we've got to travel to Boston and get this thing corrected, my mother said, as we began our mother-son sojourn. And so we left Harlem, drove across the 155th Street Bridge, crossed beyond Yankee Stadium and the projects located on the old Ebbets Field, where I'd seen Willie Mays hit towering home runs, and traveled up the Sawmill Parkway, that lyrical road that snakes along the Hudson, much as it did when it was a 19th century carriage path, gambling through the low fields and omnipresent willow trees. This route had always been my father's favorite. Although slow and torturous, it was beautiful, and it honored my parents' love for the elegiac. As I recall, my mother was dressed cunningly. She was very beautiful, with a complexion like Dorothy Dandridge. And one could see the marriage of the Indian, the Portuguese, and the African in her high cheekbones. Her hair was now white. Years before, it had been long, often pulled back. But this day, she reminded me of Janie in Zora Neale Hurston's magnificent novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. There was tremendous authority in her presentation, and yet she maintained, and how gloriously, the aura of the child with no hint of the stony ingenue. The Boston Bureau of Statistics is located near the Boston Commons, and it was sobering to pass the graves of those who had fought in the Revolution to see the statue of Crispus Attucks, a black man, the first person to die in the American Revolution, and to see the white dead so neatly packed together as if they were, in some inadvertent way, mimicking the slave ships with their horrific holds. That there was hardly room between decks for help to sweltering, stowed spoon fashion, iron, then, and some went mad and tore their flesh, writes Robert Hayden in his poem, Middle Passage. Still, Boston remains an irrefutably consequential place for me to visit. My parents were born there and lived there until they came to New York, and they had me, which affirms, obviously, that before I was born, they had a life awash in mystery. And it is always incredible to think of the world before you were present, to think of your parents as somehow free, as individuals, as having a history unencumbered by the history you represent. And yet I've never spent more than a few days in Beantown. Often regaled as a center for Americans' ethical values, the city seems the most garish of absurdities to me, given my past. Whatever the attractions of Boston, the U.S. Constitution, Bunker Hill, Faneuil Hall, and Paul Revere's workshop, my family's life there was brutally circumscribed by race. My father was always fighting. In high school, he was told that he shouldn't think of college. The unskilled trades were for him. When he took geometry, since he was going to college, the teacher, who happened to be Irish, failed him even though he had done brilliant work. The teacher didn't even grade his exam. He simply put down a big F. When my father was forced to retake geometry in summer school, he never opened a book in preparation. When he set for the exam, he scored a perfect 100. Amazingly, when a number of his white classmates failed to pass that summer, he was asked by the examiner to take a lower grade, thereby altering the curve and allowing the others to inch by, something which my father magnanimously did. When my father decided to become a physician in 1935, he applied to the three Boston medical schools, Harvard, Boston University, and Tufts, and all of them denied him entrance, even though he graduated from Boston University College of Liberal Arts, second in his class in 3 years, with a major in chemistry. In those years, none of the Boston medical schools would accept black students. Incredibly, my father was told in an interview that should he be accepted to Harvard, he would have to transfer after 2 years and graduate from a different medical school, one more fitting for my father's talents. The Harvard Dean of Admissions, an unreformed Southerner, was not going to permit a black Harvard doctor, not on his watch. Still, the inveterate hardhead, my father persisted in applying to the three schools, knowing that his chances were dim. In April, when others learned about their medical school prospects, my father received no official response from any of the institutions. There was no thin or fat envelope chilling or animating his enthusiasm. Neither declined, accepted, or waitlisted, my father's application was simply mired in eternal stasis, resting, he imagined, on some functionary's desk until America ceased to be a republic. Finally, after a wave of letters and the ultimate rejection, my father accepted the incontrovertible. He was not going to medical school in Boston, at least that year. Luckily, after a year teaching English in Pennsylvania, my father applied to Boston University and was finally admitted, where he graduated among the top three students in his medical school class. As a prerequisite of his admission, however, he was told that should any white patient object to being assigned to a black physician, he was willingly to let the patient be transferred. And though my father understandably bristled at this suggestion, he wanted to be a doctor. Still, there were some humorous moments in his medical school career, albeit bitter ones. My father heartily laughs when he recollects the time he confronted a white mental patient on the ward. The patient, who was clearly manic, took one look at my father, stuck out his tongue, rolled his eyes, and hollered, "Oh, a nigger!" My father's ambivalent delight here, I suspect, hails from his incredible sense of displacement. As the madman understood, my father was the outrigger, the outcast, the lowest of the low. This pitiable fool, like all his literary forebears, spoke all too discerningly, embodying in his abject certitude the absolute, bone-numbing desperation of my father's predicament. At home in Boston, things were a little better for my father's family. When my grandfather, the minister, walked daily to his Episcopal parish, passing through South Boston, he was often racially taunted and spat upon by the neighborhood hooligans. After a particularly galling spitting spate that endured for weeks, my grandfather came home and told his four sons that God, in his eternal goodness, had finally provided, since no one had spat at him in 5 days. Walter, the oldest of my grandfather's boys, quickly reaffirmed his father's belief that God was wonderful, neglecting to tell his father that his son, as God's emissaries, had punched numerous white boys in the mouth that spitless week. Sometimes God needs help. And Walter, too, had his contretemps. Since Walter was very light-skinned, with a mild resemblance to Charles Lindbergh, he was often mistaken for white. When one of his white girls in his class took a fancy to him, Walter was told in no uncertain terms by a teacher that he was not to take this girl out. Yet Walter did what he desired in matters of love and lust. I have a new book. Walter, these brothers of my father are even more bizarre than you can. It's much more. I'll go on and on. But anyway, Walter did what he desired in matters of love and lust, and suddenly his grades started to slip. Once his race became a matter of contention, his intelligence, lo and behold, began to falter. "How can I help you?" the registrar boldly asked my mother and me. He was in his mid-50s, wearing a blue suit and a conservative tie, and approached us with a warm, albeit reserved manner. "Sir, we have a problem, hopefully not a big one," my mother replied. I watched as my mother calculated how much time she had, what the nature of her audience was, and how her presentation might work to best effect. "Well, sir, I recently had need of my birth certificate and found out to my dismay that it contained an error concerning my race, which was listed as white. Now, I know this may seem like a small matter to you, but it's essential to me, sir. I've been black all my 62 years, and I'm proud of that. I've grown three children, helped my husband attend medical school, and faced many things, all as a black person." She waited, allowing it to sink in. "Sir, can the race be changed to black?" I don't know how many times this happens, but I would like to think it happened every day, but it doesn't. I watched the registrar as he tried to remain imperturbable, his face congealing as if nothing had ever roiled beneath its surface. I could sense that he was hoping that the registry procedures, if he could simply recall them, might proffer some guidance to handle this wild woman with her strange request. My mother, too, had seen his remote apprehension. She knew it was time to employ all her skills before he closed the door. This was the moment she had always relished in her acting career, the zero hour when a good performance, if it were to be, must sally forth. If he wasn't moved by my mother's confession, his veins were filled with quicksilver, and nothing could make the dead bones live. My children have always been told to be proud of their race. It is important to me and to my husband that they be fair to others, but that they also know who they were and whence they came, she said. I'm black. My parents were born black. I've been black as far back as I can trace. Can you change what is clearly an injustice? The word seemed to hang in the air like the airship Hindenburg before it crashed to the ground. I felt that my mother knew what she had done, how she had unleashed, like the grandest confection, something which returned us to the original, the preconceived, the preordained. It was as if we hadn't read Freud or known about Abraham Lincoln or Dr. Martin Luther King. The word injustice simply sat there molting as if we were present at the creation of the firmament. The registrar sensed his newfound station, even if he didn't know how to shoulder it, and I felt innately sorry for him. He was a good man, but he was not a visionary one. The job he held was ideally suited for him. Its contours met his enthusiasms, and he, like most of us, had become limited by its small buffetings, abandonings, and silencings. After a while, the registrar simply said, almost inaudibly, "Mrs. McLean, this is a legal document. I understand you're concerned, but I can't do anything. It's a legal document of record." My mother thanked him, seemingly convinced of her failure. But after we left the building, she told me, "We'll come back tomorrow. There'll be another registrar. I'll convince him or her." The next day, my mother was ebullient. Amazingly, my mother had not discussed the previous day's denial. At dinner, we talked about my cousins. After dinner, we talked about Cape Cod and our hope for a quiet, uneventful summer. In fact, it seemed as if my mother had completely relegated the day's comings and goings to some place beyond her interest. Wherever it was, it held no sway now. Yet I was completely caught in the present, in my imaginings. In the best instance, we would go to the registry, my mother would work her magic, and a black Mrs. McLean would prevail. In the worst scenario, we would undergo 1,000 small notion bureaucrats, and I would never leave Boston. This, too, seemed a distinct possibility. The next morning, the bright day seemed to match my mother's high spirits, and I almost found myself believing that the world would hear us. But there had been other bright days. My brother had died of alcoholism on a crisp blue morning, and so I was, to be truthful, as directed and as directionless as a butterfly. The new registrar was young, with the faintest trace of stubble, his skin as tight as a new stretched drum. When he walked over to us, I sensed that he was still learning how to be, dare I say it, officious. His walk was transitional. That is, one could see the beginnings of the man in the orchestrations of the man-child. He wasn't yet fluid. Somehow, both stages equally claimed him, and thus he was, in a word, improvisational. And yet, he himself couldn't term it that way, meant that he, unlike an artist, did not know how to use his inchoateness, that there was, that is, much mystery and little mastery. If he was not an artist, my mother was, and she welcomed the opportunity like a raptor. The young registrar walked over, and my mother began her speech. "Young man, you don't know what it means to live a lie. You're young, but I'm near 70. I won't be here much longer, and it's important to me and my family to be who I am. The doctor listed me incorrectly as white on my birth certificate, but I'm black and proudly so. You, young man, there must be things you believe, things you would never betray. The young man looked sheepish, and I realized that this was taking all he learned at Harvard or Boston University or Holy Cross and spinning it like a dervish. I watched the young boy's face, my mother's. He'd made a connection, and my mother saw it too. Young man, can you change the document? Can you rectify a great wrong? The registrar began to say something about the document, but he stopped himself. Then, as if in a dream, he offered, "Oh, lady, let me have your certificate." The young registrar briskly walked away, as if he had found his new legs, and disappeared behind a large screen. In about 5 minutes, he returned with a new birth certificate, with the race boldly listed as black, and presented it to my mother. My mother was ecstatic. She wanted to kiss the boy, but she also perceived his newly assumed agency and didn't wish to embarrass him. The registrar smiled broadly, evidencing his great pleasure. My mother and he had moved continents. It's true. I don't know whether that young registrar changed my mother's color in the official state registry. I doubt if he did, although it is possible. For my mother, the truth had went out. For myself, it was another odd moment in a litany of racial episodes, all of which make sense, but only if you are an American and believe that an ounce of melanin, real or imagined, bespeaks something pivotal, foundational, and incontestable. Only, that is, if you believe, like the doctor and my mother, in the American way which sadly separates each of us from the other, in cemetery and housing project, love and industry, life and death. It means something to be black, my mother would proudly attest, and her life indeed proves as much as does my life and those that preceded it. And it means something to be white, which too is full of celebrations, disappointments, and incoherencies. And at bottom, it means something to be American, which is the embodiment of all this deformation, the white and black, the black and white, this experiment which, many years ago, presented a white person and a black person with eyes that might have intuited anything, but instead found solace in imagining how they differed, and created a legion of codes and prevarications so fantastic they approach the pathological. Thank you. Oh, yeah. I'd love to take questions. Yes, hey, yes, sir.
In the... I actually had the pleasure of meeting you both last spring, and one of the things I did, I shared the essay that you did about your parents having Alzheimer's.
Yes.
And with my writing teacher, mm-hmm. I was taking some material, and she surprised me because when we came back to talk about the essay, she started talking about the words you use and the fact that she had to have a dictionary next to her in order to really fully grasp. And that's actually surprising. I didn't know not quite how to take it. And then when I reread the essay, mm-hmm. actually I appreciated your essay even more so. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to share that with you and also just to get your feeling on the power of words that you use when you're writing your essays.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. The last essay in this book is one about both of my parents had Alzheimer's. They died of Alzheimer's. I'll tell you, if I look at my life in one way, it's really bleak. But the fact is, all my parents love me, and it isn't bleak at all. I mean, I really have. I had the most charmed existence, even though terrible things happened. Huh? Because I knew, right, at the bottom. I'll tell you a very quick thing, and then I'll answer your question. I want to say something. I've been something really strange. You know, when I came to Cornell, I'm going to say one thing about my parents because I can, because I'm here. When I first came to Cornell, I was thinking about this. You know how one thing sort of engenders another thing. I hadn't thought about this, but my parents. I don't think my father believed in psychology. A lot of doctors at that point didn't. They said they did, but they didn't. But he had an uncanny ability to know some things. And I don't know where he got it from. But when I came to Cornell in 69,
He did something which I'll never forget. I didn't know what was going on. I came up here, you know, as all of you were freshmen probably once, some of you may be freshmen now. I came up here from Harlem. I must admit, I didn't know what the hell to do in Ithaca. I mean, I couldn't figure it out. At that point, they had like 2 movie theaters, right? But I remember my father did something incredible. He got the phone book, right? Went downtown. I didn't know what he's doing. Came back to my room. Suddenly, puts an envelope on the bulletin board, and it says emergency. And he says, my nickname was Chip. He said, Chip, take a look at this. So I open it up, and it's the bus ticket. And he said, think about this. He said, if there is ever a moment where you doubt yourself, you feel inessential, you feel that people don't care about you, you take this thing, no questions asked, and you come home to those people who will always love you. I'll never forget that. Do you know what I'm saying? That essential collaboration is so powerful. There's nothing white folks can do to me or anybody else, right, after that, you know. So all I'm saying to you very quickly, gosh, I'm in this high point here, is love your kids, huh? But back to your question about all these words. I don't know. You know, the funny thing is I came to writing. I came to writing because of the music. I mean, if I write essays at all, I hope they're lyrical, are they? They need to be. That's what I mean, I wrote poems because of music. I think almost every writer I know, Ralph Ellison says this too, wished that he or she was a composer. Right? You know. You might paint some, but you really wanted to be a musician. Right? You just weren't good enough. Yes?
Ken, I have so many questions I'd love to ask, but I restrain myself. I think one thing is very clear. I've thought about it a lot. Oh. Whatever we do in life, what can we reflect on, remember about our life histories? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like how you have the interweaving of your parental influences.
Yeah.
Some people are fortunate enough to have
absolutely
parents there.
Absolutely.
Others are.
Right.
But the way in which this thing goes, that each of us has a life story.
Absolutely.
That we may not think maybe that important.
Right.
But it could be very important not only
absolutely
for communities like us, but right for the self. And then go to the self. Mm-hmm. In putting these essays together, mm-hmm, what impact did it have on you?
Absolutely.
Beyond your ad hoc memories.
Right.
You put them together, you could re-reflect.
Yes.
On you, the person, and the impact
right
this
right
story
right
had on you.
Well, you know, it's funny. There's an essay here, for example, about Dr. King staying with us. That's a really powerful sort of essay for me. And it was very incredible because when he was at our house, I was eight, and everybody, anyway, this was right after he'd been stabbed, and there was a woman who actually came into this. We had a Volkswagen bus, and he had done 350 speeches that year to bring in money. And nobody knew where he was for safety reasons, so he just happened to be with us in the vineyard, and I was very lucky, and I was a kid. And I remember this woman comes on the bus, right? And she has this incredible hat and comes up to Dr. King. And everybody, once they saw Dr. King, right, everybody queued up. Everybody knew who he was. And everybody would talk to him. And the amazing thing about Dr. King was that Dr. King had this ability almost immediately and I think this is what really charisma is. We always think of charisma as being the person being self-infested. I don't think it is. I think it's actually the other. What happens is the person actually that you talk to very often sees themselves in you and sees themselves in some sense transmogrified into something larger. And the thing about Dr. King was when he was talking to those people for those 10 minutes, right, they were the most important person in the world. In fact, the brilliance of Dr. King, I think, was that actually very few truly great leaders can both lead and follow. He could actually take strength from people. I remember, there's a very famous moment, Wilbur talks about this in an essay, where he saw Dr. King one time where Dr. King was in a church, right, and Roy Wilkins was there, and everybody was there. And this was when the White Citizens Council was all around. This, it was, I think it was in Binghamton, Birmingham. And all of a sudden, Dr. King is calling the Justice Department, right? And Roy Wilkins says to him, he says, "Martin, aren't you scared? Aren't you scared?" Right? Understandably. And Dr. King looks at the audience, and he says, "Do you see these people here? Many of whom will be arrested for 5 or 6 months when we get out, right? Right? The Justice Department won't know about them." He said, "They're not scared. It's not permissible for us to be scared." Do you see what I'm saying? That ability, interestingly enough, to feed off that is really quite gorgeous. I guess what I tried to do, and I've always felt that all experience for me is a parable, right? The gift of anything that I've learned, I'm only returning it back. It's almost as I'm just a vessel, right? And it really seems, I mean, in some sense, I've been lucky. I mean, it just seemed to me that everything was there when I needed it. When I was about to falter, somebody came, you know, and stood up. I mean, I've been very, very lucky. I mean, I did it exactly the way I wanted to, right? Through no fault of my own, not through genius. I actually muddled through, but I muddled through with a certain level of grace. And the grace didn't come from me. It came from people around me. You know, I have just been enormously loved by my parents, by people in this room, which is why I always want to return that. I mean, just be a mirror. That's all you have to do. It's like a sunflower. You ever notice, they call it a sunflower because the sun comes out of it? You know, it looks like a sunflower, right? Just give it back. I think this idea of, I think the hard thing though about the kind of writing that I'm interested in doing is it seems easier than it is, because you have to figure out some way, right, to both say something. I mean, it's really, I mean, all of us have experiences and stuff, and we should. The hard thing though is not to do two things. One thing is you have to figure out some way, interestingly enough, to make it hopefully not self-indulgent. Right. I'm doing a piece right now, and I'm thinking about it because this is on it. I've been really, my parents and I in 1956, and I'll shut up, 1956, went to Washington, D.C. And some of you probably know, we were there doing the stuff you do, and we were staying with Frank Snowden, wrote Black Sand Antiquity, okay. And I'll tell you this because it has something to do with the story. While we were there, we did the stuff. We were going to go around. We're Northerners, and we're really dumb Northerners. I mean, we don't know anything about much. So we took the bus tour, right? We took a bus tour going to see all the landmarks. And so the bus goes, we go to Mount Vernon. And I remember this succinctly because two things happened that I'll never forget. One was my brother, I think, the reason I think my brother is dead, in all honesty, is that I, in some sense, had a certain level of looking at the world, a certain level of absurdity. We can call it a sense of humor, we can call it whatever, sort of distancing. My brother didn't. My brother actually, if my brother saw something, it was like as if he were just, it was like he was a giant tuning fork. Everything just sort of went through him. And he could never, in some sense, throw it off. And you'd see immediately what was bothering him, right? I remember right now, if you go to Mount Vernon, there's a very elaborate slave quarters. They don't have that. They didn't have that then. But when we went there, I remember there was this area where the slaves had been. It was pretty rough. And I remember my brother doing something very strange. My brother all of a sudden just sort of hunkered down, right? He was only about 3. And I realized that it was almost as if at that moment, right, he became a sort of sack of stones, and the whole enormity of that stuff just claimed him, right? And I would actually argue at that moment, in some sense, I knew something about my brother, which I wish I had known. I really wish I knew all the ramifications of that. So So that happened. I was conscious of that. But the other thing is, all of a sudden, it's really bizarre. We go, right, on the bus tour, and the bus tour stops, as bus tours do, that are whole days, to get lunch. So we go to this place, have lunch. Only thing I remember is that we go to lunch. You know, my father's real happy, smothered chicken, blah, 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 right? I do remember that the clerking staff was black, and I noticed that all of them came out, and they looked at us with a very odd look, which is a look that I know, right? And that's all I remember, right? Remember, we finished, went home. Came back. Dr. Snowden had a party for my parents, right? He says, "Where did you all eat?" We said, "McNichols." He said, "No, you didn't." My father says, "Yes, we did." And then Dr. Snowden said, "No, you didn't." And my father said, you know, it started to be, and I started to realize that it got really testy. What had happened was that we actually integrated that place. We were the first blacks to ever to be fed there. Civil rights avatar without even realizing it. But what that was happening there, of course, two things. It's very possible. The possible readings of this, and let me see why I like to do the kind of writing. There are a couple of possible readings of this. One is, those of you who know about history know that my father looked, you know, I have a kind of generic third world face, which gets me in a lot of trouble when I go out of the country. I'm always like, whatever they don't like, I'm always in trouble. But what I think may have happened with my, remember that in the South at points, if my father was Indian, he was served, right? If he was African, not Afro-American, he was served. This is real. So I think that's one possible reading. The other possible reading, and this is also, it might be, that the waitress thought this stuff was stupid and just did it, right? Or there's also a possibility that there's that weird moment of, what, you know something? So much of our rituals in this country, right, are people in some sense paying attention to them? It's very hard, right? Remember the whole thing about wrote the book about nigger so-and-so of your mother, the comedian.
Dick Gregory.
Remember the whole thing about we don't serve Negroes, I don't eat them either? Right? That idea, you remember that line? That idea, though, that there are ways in which you can kind of get into something almost in the way that Ralph Ellison talks about it, right? Where you can kind of, you can get in kind of the interstices of things and weird things can happen. I don't know what's happening there, but I wanted to talk about it because it struck me as being the kind of stuff that really does interest me about life, you know? And it seems to me our job, all of you have incredible experiences. I also would tell you as a writer that you need to write. You need to write because erasure is very, very real. There are real historians in here. I'm not a historian. I'm a sad excuse for anything. But I do the best. But I can write a sentence, you know. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think you need to find ways in which you can both substantiate yourself, corroborate yourself, and I think through that process, if you do it well, corroborate others. Anybody else? Yes.
Can you share with us if you had consciousness as a child of the lesson, if you take two from the passage, section you read, your father, who did not get discouraged, who went back, reapply. Your mother who said, we'll come back tomorrow. And there was certainly many, many other things. How did it shape you in terms of your confidence in life, that when you do this, when your mother said it's about justice, and suddenly your father was also driven by it's just.
Right.
I graduated second of my class. So how did it shape you, and probably your brother? brother also. Mm-hmm. That when you're fighting for something that is just,
yeah,
regardless of the obstacles, you must find ways. I don't know how to,
yeah,
but you need to shape you, but you have consciousness that it was shaping you in terms of your attitude toward life.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot of things. I mean, first of all, there was this real sense, some of that came from just being, that there was also that New England sense that you sort of, you know, you articulate stuff. I will say there's another thing, though, that was slightly... there was a slightly negative taint to that, too. I was the first black in the oldest school in America, which is also in the book. What I'm trying to say, it's not that I just fell my, you know, I was afflicted by my own experience in some weird way. But that meant, and my parents, of course, we went to the school because their idea was you went to the best school you could go to. The problem was, for me personally, and for my brother too, we both went there, it was really complicated going to this, you know, school that was founded in 1616, graduated 13 presidents, you know. And when I say it has nothing to do with me, in my case, I think it was because I am by nature I was just sort of artistic. I mean, maybe autistic, but my problem was that that sense of what they took as being important, right? The idea of being first in your class, always being competitive and stuff. That strikes me as deadly. I just don't buy it, right? So in some ways, I think that my parents' sense was you always do this stuff and stuff. I really understand it. I respect it. I certainly respect it in them. I think there's some drawbacks. And the school I was at, I mean, it was bizarre. I mean, to be in a school where I remember I'm in the third grade, I put up my hands, and the, you know, teachers say stuff like, would the colored kid in the red coat answer the question? You know, and it would go on like that, you know, year after year after year. It was also complicated. It was all male school, right? Which I think are by nature corrosive anyway. You know, I mean, like men need to be told that they have more, that they have privilege. Do you know what I mean? You know. So anyways, it was complicated. The thing that is good about going to places like that is that I can always criticize them. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, I know exactly what they do and know what they don't do. You know, just like those of you who've been here know what places like this do and what places like this don't do, hopefully. Yes.
It seems to suggest that your brother took a different approach, though.
Yeah.
Because I remember a section in the essay where you talk about your brother. I can sort of envision him basically giving people the fingers. He's driving.
Yep. So, That's right. He was a tough guy. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right.
There's no sense of this.
No.
Well, I'll come back tomorrow. I mean, see,
yeah.
if he was dealing with that registrar, he probably would have cursed the registrar out.
My brother was astonishing. My brother that way. I mean, I was always worried he was going to get killed. Because, but my brother was also, you know, my brother, now this is the weird thing. My brother, when my brother was three or two, I remember he packed all his stuff up. Now, kids do this. But I remember, he packed all his stuff up, and he had decided, we were 147, so he had decided, he had packed all his stuff up. And I watched him, he's going out the door. And so I'm looking at him and say, Paul, where are you going? He says, nothing place, or something like that. And it's something where he was like two. But the weird thing about it was that I always felt, in some way, he was, you know, it was almost like the stork went to the wrong house. Right? I mean, it was really tough for him. I mean, we were all morning people. My brother stayed up all night. He was also, by the way, he was an incredible jazz musician. My brother used to play drums with Carmen McRae. I mean, he was a serious jazz musician, but he didn't do it. I mean, you know, didn't make him. And then my brother had the exact same IQ to me to the point. So, yeah. It shows you, yes.
Is the pathology of your last paragraph permanent?
The pathology?
You mentioned pathology.
Oh, okay.
Your last paragraph. Is that permanent?
Let me see if I can. Well, I do. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, what I was trying to say in that last paragraph is that what's always been complicated for me was that, at least in this country, it always seems like having clarity. We always put a premium on clarity. But clarity, as it's often read in this country, defines you away from things that are really clarifying for you. Do you know what I'm saying? Then those to talk about the kind of all the sort of intersections that were going on in my family, right? To pay attention, have real fidelity of that stuff, right? It seems to me using a kind of the binary ways we look at stuff doesn't help me a whole lot. If that makes sense, right? I think we're in a really interesting transitional moment. We're always in a transitional moment here, right? But we're always at a crossroads. I mean, we're being told every day, you know, that we're post-race. Post-race? I mean, it's worse now than it was 5 years ago. I mean, come on, what are we doing, right? Yeah. No, I don't think so. I think as long as we other, it's never going to end. We just see people. As soon as you see somebody, if we could just see somebody, wouldn't it be nice if I could just see somebody who just happened to be and just say, gee, that person, you know, has a different shade, and do no more with it than just note it. But we don't do that. We haven't learned how to do that, have we? You know? We should go. You should go get something to drink or something. I've spoken far too long, over long. Have fun. All right, okay. Please.
To position people reminds me a lot of the kind of verbal shorthand that can happen in the South, where people seem to put folks in one category or another, and automatically it does a kind of shorthand for you. It lets you know the backstory, so to speak, so that
right.
you can attach a range of characteristics
right.
to a certain group and then automatically know kind of what is going to happen or anticipate the story. So I found that fascinating. My question relates to the essay in your book about the experience of having taught at the alternative school, because it seems to have in some ways been a counterintuitive decision, and I'm wondering about its impact on your career, your trajectory, how you feel that particular experience was distinct and shaped your life.
You're talking about the essay about working with the profoundly handicapped kids? Yes. Well, you know, the thing is, actually, it isn't so different because, remember, my sister didn't breathe. It was really... My sister... I have a sister who's actually calls me every day. And I speak for her for exactly 1 minute a day, every day, and she's 70. And my sister lives in a shelter workshop. But my sister, when she was born, didn't breathe for 7 minutes. But she's incredibly high-functioning, given that. But, you know, so I guess in some sense it was actually, it's sort of like, you know, I do prison stuff because I always think about my brother who was, I don't know, often there for 5 or 6 minutes, you know what I'm saying? And I think in some sense, so it, in a way, it was sort of having a kind of fidelity with my sister. But you're right. I mean, that essay was, again, one of those things that really fell right in my lap. I mean, it seemed to me that it was almost as if these people were metaphors for me. I mean, I was supposed to learn, right? She's talking about a really, I had this job where I was working with a profound handicap. I'm talking about people who had IQs of 15. These are people that, if you can teach them to use a knife and a fork, it might take a year. Right. And there were two students I worked with five students, but there were two students who were just astonishing. One student I called a love machine. He really was. This kid, he was astonishing. If you came into the room, he would try to hug you. And more importantly, he would vocalize and he would just go, and he was really trying to kiss everything. But the problem was, he would try to do that to anything, even a car. so we'd get killed. I mean, the only reason, the institution was the first time I'd ever seen an institution that actually was healthy, because that institution made certain he lived. He could not live. I mean, forgetting even some of his own, of sort of his cognitive stuff, it was also that this guy was, he was going to grab a car and get killed. Then there was another kid. These were actually, this is the first day I'm there. Then there's another guy, right? It was a kind of cherubic looking kid, but he's a really strange looking kid. And I'm told by the teacher, who was actually Oliver Sacks, kind of very famous guy, saying, you know, you need to read the folder on this kid. And I don't like reading folders, you know. Those of you who are teaching probably know. I was afraid that, you know, if I read the, I'm going to have all this stuff. I kept saying, read his folder. Oh, so finally I said, you know, because I'm left-handed, I'm a little afraid of reading. You know, they say left-handed people are conflicted. I don't want to deal with that. So I finally read the thing. And it says, this kid says, homicidal. It says, homicidal with masochistic tendencies. I'm saying, what? You know what I'm saying? IQ 15? What does that mean? Right? Well, no sooner, I'm told to take this kid and put this kid on the bus, right? That's my job, I take him to the bus. So I take the kid up, put him on the bus, belt him in. The young man extends his arm. I take his arm. He grabs my hand, all sticks in his mouth, bites into it, and the blood is coming out of my knuckles, right? And, you know, it hurts like the dickens. And, you know, I really want to hit the kid. You can't do that, right? So I yell, stop it, right? Because it really hurts. The kid breaks out in the most incredible smile. And then I say, oh, my word. All right, that happens in 1 minute. And about 3 minutes later, right, I'm supposed to go and get another young lady, put her on the bus. So I'm going to get her. All of a sudden, I look. The same young man jumps, he gets out of the thing, runs, right, grabs a young girl and throws her in front of an oncoming car. The car just luckily misses a complement of children and doesn't hit her. And then the kid breaks out in the same smile. So I've got this love machine on the left and I got absolute evil on the right, you know? So I have Martin Luther King and Dick Cheney. Right? And, you know, and I said to myself, this is it. I mean, it seems to me, can anything preach better than that? I mean, it just seemed to me, I had the whole world right there.
Well, I think we should
stop this part. Anytime. Well, thank you. Thanks so much.